because I left planes and cars to get there. Woo, and they know you. It's a good feeling.
Yeah. When you have the world at your fingertips, when you guys broke Woodstock, you play Woodstock, you play like 4 in the morning. What was that like?
Getting off. I never saw that many people about music, for any others, and whatever. And getting off a helicopter, like an army helicopter, or after a car, then a helicopter, and then dropping with all those people.
Yeah.
I was like, we better do the best we can.
Yeah, you think?
Yeah.
It's 4 o'clock in the morning, and there's still an ocean of people, more people than you've ever seen.
Yep.
So you guys had already broken. You were already
not as good as Woodstock did.
Woodstock broke you open.
Yeah.
James Early. It's because of people like him that I knew that it was possible for me, and that helped to drive me and motivate me to do it. Not think about doing it, but actually do it.
Thomas McElroy.
Sly Stone gave us hope, and a person that was from our community that had done something really great and was being applauded for it. So it's like, we got this rich tradition here that we got to hold up or we can be a part of. Sly kind of paved the way, along with a whole bunch of other people, for people like Denny and I and Frankie Beverly and Maze even, and the Tonys and the hip-hop that was born here, Hammer, everybody else, Too Short. He kind of opened that up. You know, we all learn from each other. And I listened to all the music, and I remember putting the needle back on the drum break on that one song, that Digital Underground. I remember, like, putting the needle back. I was like, that's cool. And then I would listen to that, but I would, like, come back to that drum break. That was like kind of a defining moment for me. I remember in my life where I was listening for something specific. Why am I coming back to this part? Why am I doing this? Sly Stone, I love this song. He's got all kind of people in the group. He looks different. He's not really R&B. He's not really rock. He's something different. He's kind of like Miles Davis. He's kind of like some of these other guys I'm looking at. He's such a strong character, and it really influenced me in a way that made me listen to popular music differently, even though at that point I didn't understand. And later on I got into jazz. I came back to Sly later and listened to him and understood what he was doing at that time, and then started listening to Larry Graham and some of the other people, and that had a huge influence on the whole Bay Area. I remember when I was a kid watching Sly Stone on TV. I saw him and the band, and I noticed right away he had a white dude, a woman, and just different colors of people in his band before I noticed anything else. And I had never seen that before. I was like, who is that? And then I remember looking at an album cover sometime later in my house as a kid. I said, oh, that's the dude. This is Sly Stone.
Growing up in Vallejo, you couldn't escape racial integration.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody was there.
Mm-hmm.
What was it like having a racially integrated band back then?
It was planned.
Yeah?
Yeah.
It was a conscious thought for you to bring that to the world.
Yeah, we thought it was a good idea.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, another thing, I mean, and we took this into our fold, too. Those groups are always into the community. They gave mm-hmm. back. I mean, it's like the community gave back to them, too. It was me growing up in West Oakland. I lived across the street from the Infirmary Park. Mm. The Black Panthers used to do a lot of rallies across it. So he was pretty much one of them. You can call him damn near the house band for when they would do those rallies and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So he was always a part of the community. I guess that's a little why I do the things I do, because that's what I've seen.
Civil rights movement comes along, and you get to say, well, we've already been doing it.
Yeah, we did. Well, I remember I was going to march, and I got in front of the line, and I realized that I had a .32 caliber. I forgot about Martin Luther King everything.
Right, because you were going to march.
Yeah, but I got scared.
Yeah, mm-hmm. .32 automatic on my person. So, wow. And I guess that's probably one of the reasons why you didn't have a much more visible presence in the civil rights movement.
Yeah, because I went with my mind. That's why they were going to hurt us.
Uh-huh.
In my mind, was, I better get the fuck up out of here.
Wow.
So that's right.
What civil rights movement was trying to accomplish, they could just look at your band and see it in action and see that it was beautiful and that everybody was better for it.
Mm-hmm.
And then you were going to march and you had a...
Yeah, I was going to get in the front.
Uh-huh.
And I looked at all those people and some of them had weapons. And I realized that I had my .32.
Yeah.
That was just the subconscious to have it.
Right.
Because
that's what it was about back then.
Yeah. I mean,
you still did grow up in Vallejo. And Vallejo is already, has always been what it is.
Yeah, Vallejo's pretty harsh.
You had to survive it.
Yeah.
You were on every show that someone who was... had a career in music could be on. You know, you guys were on American Bandstand, Soul Train, all that. You took over the Mike Douglas show.
Yeah.
We were watching the Mike Douglas show. We saw clips from the Mike Douglas show. Who was that was on there?
On the Mike Douglas show?
Yeah, with you.
I had Richard Pryor.
Richard Pryor.
We made him play drums.
Yeah, I had Muhammad Ali.
Muhammad Ali, that's right. It's a good thing you didn't make him play drums.
You know, you and Muhammad came at the social movement from a different angle.
Mm-hmm.
You seem to be much more inclusive in trying to say, hey, we got to work together.
Mm-hmm.
And Muhammad came at another viable way of saying, we got to get our equal part, you know?
Mm-hmm.
People look to you guys for answers. How do you guys reckon that between each other?
Muhammad Ali, he likes to rhyme, but not with any substance, as far as I can see.
Okay.
And he started to rhyme, and he started talking about, about black people, white people, and he told me that I should, I forgot what he was saying, but I didn't like it. So I had to ask him to be quiet. I mean, he got mad.
I remember that. Yeah, that's on the show.
Yeah.
But I encouraged him.
Yeah.
To be cool.
You encouraged him to be cool.
Yeah.
Everything is so good. He makes a lot of money. I make a lot of money. But his brothers and uncles of mine are catching hell and hungry. And we on TV.
Yeah.
Like everything is so rosy. And I can't go off.
Yeah,
I'm guilty.
Yeah,
there's too many wise people.
Muhammad. I'm talking now, man. Okay. The only thing we can do for brothers is to do what we're doing. Be examples. And to be happy. And to be intelligent. Like you are, and like you always say.
Thank you. In the diss on to intelligence, the debate with the brother on television, you know, I even clown with him on television, but behind the doors, we can have a good time, but not with all the people watching.
That's not being honest, what you just said.
That's what I'm saying. We'd
clown
be
behind
phony.
Doors.
We'd be phony if we didn't do the same
if
thing.
I had a clown
not here with the, we
no,
did.
No. You just said clown.
I said, if I had any clown,
don't you agree with me?
Yeah, we're going to clown around. If you don't like it, I'm going to whoop you.
That says it all right there.
Yeah.
You encouraged Muhammad Ali to be cool. It took some guts to do that because if...
Well, you have to do that when you just carried Ali.
Sure.
You have to wake up.
I guess so.
Yeah.
Because there he is. He's a big presence. He'll mow right over everybody in the room and really just kind of take over all the energy if you don't stand up for yourself.
Mm-hmm.
What's your greatest high? What's your highest moment that just sticks out in your mind?
Have the group rehearse it, probably.
Your highest highs happen during rehearsal.
Yeah.
So when it...
Corey's like, what?
When it's,
I say it all the time.
Grab a mic, man. Grab a mic.
No. There's some cornbread over here. I've always said, and I tell people, that rehearsals are better than shows.
Mm-hmm.
Because you get that first high, that first time you run down the whole song and it sounds great.
Yeah.
It's not like that at a show.
Mm-hmm.
So,
Corey, your episode of our podcast was last week.
Yeah, no, I'm just saying.
Why do you want to bring up old shit?
But I've always said that.
Yes, you have always said that. So how about this? I'll ask you this, Sly, because we're in Corey's presence, and Corey's played with you. And one of the things that he mentioned was that during rehearsal is when you really get to flex and you really get to try things and you get to – because when you're out in the – you have an obligation to your audience, right? So you have to pull it back just a little bit. Make sure you're playing safe. You're not going to reach for the most acrobatic thing to do musically. You're going to Just take it back just a little bit to make sure that you don't mess up in front of your audience. Is that why you find rehearsal to be more stimulating than anything else? Well,
yeah, but my band was the major high. Not just playing with people.
Yeah.
The band, to have the band.
Yeah.
Because they were every day.
Yeah.
Until it was, you can't even make mistakes.
Yeah. Well, you guys were always known for your incredible work ethic and just how tight the band always was and just how together your show always was. With that caliber of performance and delivering it night after night after night for so long, what happened with the band? I mean, I know these are things that happen to all bands, but how did it happen to Sly and the Family Stone?
When we started going off?
Yeah.
I got a rumor passed to me that I was going to kill Larry.
Wow.
The bass player.
Yeah.
And what I did all the time was protect everybody in the band.
Sure.
I mean, every time, a lot of fights. Every fight.
It was Sly and the Family Stone. You were the paternal figure of the band. Yeah. You were the leader.
Yeah.
That's how it started, the unraveling of the band?
That's what's right in my head.
Yeah.
I want to try to go get him to work. The fuck, what are you talking about?
So this was a rumor that was passed to you and one that probably altered everybody's behavior before you heard about it.
Well, everybody else in the band, they treated like a, nah, he was sad, man. Don't worry about that.
Yeah. But how did Larry take it?
He's gone. Couldn't check in front.
And that was the, wow.
Yeah, I guess he's still saying it.
From Huey Lewis in the News, Johnny Colet.
I actually had the honor to introduce Sly to Huey. My God, it was probably the late 80s. And Sly still had that gleam in his eye. That might be the last time I saw Sly for the post-Grammys event. So that's the last time we saw each other. I had a fledgling band in Marin County. It turns out they wanted to be a rock band, and we were a little too funky for them. Larry and I got unceremoniously released from our band, Soundhole. A couple weeks later, and don't ask me how, John got a seat playing keyboards with Sly. And Sly lived right up the hill in Novato, California. I'm just green with jealousy. I didn't have two nickels to run together at the time. He said, well, hold on, maybe something's going to happen here. It looks like the horn section needs some help. And I don't know who was in the band at the time, but one day John comes by and he says, come on up, man. Sly wants to meet you. Our mutual ground, I guess you might say, was both Sly and I went to Vallejo Junior College. And we both held David Folick, the music teacher there, in high regard. The fact that I went to Vallejo JC and went through Frolic at the slide that slid up and said, I got to meet the guy, And I went up and we hung out at his place up there in Novato for about an hour or two and did whatever people did back when they're in your early 20s. And, 3 hours later, we said goodbye and Sly said, John Cola, you're in the band, man. So, but he was convinced I was the right guy. And that was the beginning of a few years of a crash course in what not to do in the music business, I guess.
Yeah.
No, it was a lot of great time. And you were in a bit of a challenge at the time. I think Sly just released High on You not more than a year before, maybe. And it didn't do so well, I think. I don't think he released two or three singles off it. And his manager at the time had put some pressure on it to get this. It's all about branding. Mm-hmm. And Sly Stone wasn't branding. Sly and the Family Stone was a brand. And so I guess the pressure was on Sly to put a band back together and be Sly and the Family Stone. That's what he set out to do. Mm-hmm. And I think when John and I came in, he really found something to hang his hat on. I'm not just patting myself on the back, but musicians were coming and going. We had these three guys from Sacramento called themselves the Chocolate Chips, and they were kind of the rhythm section, bass, drums, and guitar. And I don't know if those guys knew it, but their job was on the line a little bit. And Cynthia was kind of in, but she'd only show up if she was sure rehearsal was going to happen because she had a little baby. And somehow we managed to squeeze it off and get it together and get a record out and go on tour for a year or so. You know, the record probably heard You Miss Me While I'm Back. I think I can say with some confidence I might be the only white male that ever sang on a Sly Stone session. So I was pretty honored about that, you know. I think Sly hit the button and said, "Yeah, Cody, you sing it with him." That's one I like to remember. I think I can say now I understand that the effort was to get the brand back and get Sly back on the charts and back out on the road. And we had a ball on tour. My fondest memories. Sly had this mandate put on him that you got a tour. That's just the way the music business is. The manager at the time laid that down. We went out with the Ohio Players and Bob Womack and Harold Melvin, the Blue Notes, when Teddy Pendergrass was singing with him, and the Barquets and Rufus. And I just had the time of my life. It was just a blast. So we opened for P-Funk for about 2 or 3 weeks. And I get to meet all the guys in P-Funk and jump on stage at the end of their set for the big finale. And, you know, the fantastic memories. Thanks, Sly.
When you played with Sly, how do you characterize his musical gift?
Well, I'd say he's one of the best songwriters and charismatic characters I've ever had the honor of being in their presence. He had something that, you know, there's something you only see, you know, in people like Sam Cooke and Marvin Gaye. There's a magic and a charisma that carries through, and you become charmed. And that was part of the whole thing. I'm sure there was a power struggle early on when Sly's charm started to take over, but he earned it. He was a DJ. He was jumping back and forth, spinning records and trying to start a band. He was doing three things at once when he was young, and he earned that. And he was really good at it. You know, he wrote for the times, and he wrote all the right stuff. He hit a nerve for white folks and black folks, and you know that's why we remember those songs to this day.
That's what he said.
My goodness. Wow. Yeah. You're making all that music. You're the hit of the party. Everything revolves around the good time. I mean, Sly and the Family Stone is a rolling good time.
Mm-hmm.
Now, prior to you walking in the room for this podcast, we had the pleasure of hanging out with you a couple weeks ago. And we were both profoundly affected by a number of things that you said.
Mm.
That's really why we wanted to have you back and have a microphone in front of you.
Good.
So, yeah, that, I mean, yeah, we feel like it's important.
Yeah, it is.
It is. Sly, will you tell us about the first time you performed in front of a live audience?
Yeah, it was a church song.
Okay.
It was a church song in Oakland Auditorium. And, what's the name? Brother Joe May and, you ever heard of that? No, not Joe May. Anyway, church groups, Blind Boys and all those people. And I went and they put me on a table to sing. I sang, and when it was over, then people, they were happy, and I wasn't ready for that. They started coming at me, running, and getting happy out of here, and I got up and ran and back. I got off the table and ran.
Your first live performance, you took off running.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, buddy.
Yeah, I mean, from there to Woodstock, you came a long way in a short amount of time.
I saw Sly and the Family Stone when I was 16 years old at the Spectrum in Philadelphia.
Dr. Robert Greenberg.
So this would have been 1970. The Spectrum in Philly was where the 76ers used to play. It was, you know, the big arena. And it was fantastic. And, of course, I instantly got stoned simply by breathing. We were sitting up in the balcony, and, man, forget it. No one could stay straight.
Smoke rises.
Oh, don't you know it. And it took us about 3 hours to get home that night because we just kept thinking, where are we?
Yeah.
It was a wonderful night.
Yeah.
It was just, you know, it was just fantastic.
How old were you when that happened, that first live performance?
About 9, 10, something like that.
Now, your Wikipedia biography, mm-hmm. I don't know who wrote that for you, but it says that you began playing when you were very young. What was your first instrument?
I think it was piano, I think.
It was piano.
Drums.
Okay. So what your Wikipedia entry says was that you had mastered your first instrument when you were about 7, and then you became proficient on practically everything else on the stage when you were about 9 or 10.
Well, I would get a gig on whatever instrument. You know, I didn't know what a master was, except I would learn it well enough
yeah.
to get a gig. I think
master is a strong word. Yeah. You know, to say that somebody has mastered something, mm-hmm. it requires a level of proficiency. Knowing this as a musician, your Wikipedia entry was probably written by somebody who's not a musician. So it's easy for them to throw words like that around. Mm-hmm. But you were good enough to get a gig when you were 7 years old. You were good enough to get a gig on several other instruments when you were nine. And so the difference, though, between a seasoned musician and somebody who's 9 years old is you get in front of an audience and they go crazy for you and you take off running.
I wasn't ready for that energy. Right.
Yeah.
So do you still play today?
Yeah.
What instruments do you grab? Like, if you're going to sit down right now and grab something, what do you play?
Well, probably a synthesizer. A lot of drums with you.
This is songwriter and record producer Preston Glass.
The great thing about Sly Stone, well, he was a big influence on me growing up when I was cutting my teeth as a songwriter. So I think his music taught me how to expand and not feel like I had to be in a box. Melodically, he stretched stuff chord-wise, lyrically, he could do a message song and make it sound like it's a fun song, you know. Talk about a political situation and make it sound like it's a happy song. Sly Stone's music, to me, crosses all genres, all borders. The music that was at heart soulful and gospel-y, but at the same time, very pop, very accessible, yet he was very edgy.
All right, this feels almost illegal to know, but our windows were so old and just desperately needed to be replaced. So I called a few contractors, but they all quoted me.
Because of some of the lyrics he tackled. So today, while a lot of people are complaining about quality of the music out there, you could still see his influence in some of the bands, in rap music, in alternative music, and lyrically, he was very free.
Now, can I tell a story? Because we know that you want to make music all the time. Because the way that we met you was we were hanging out with Corey on a Sunday night. Mm-hmm. It was Sunday night. And you called Corey and you said, Corey, I need a Mac laptop with GarageBand on it. Mm-hmm. I got some ideas I got to put down right now. Mm-hmm. And it was Sunday night. Mm-hmm. Now, I know you've spent a long time as a rock star. And not a lot of people in your life tell you no when it comes to, I want to make music. Everybody says, well, let's get Sly making music. We want Sly to make music. So that's what we did. We mobilized and we got you a laptop with GarageBand on it. But it happened on a Sunday night. The other thing I want to say about this story was that we bought this laptop because it had GarageBand on it. And the guy who was selling it said, yeah, I use different applications and I've updated and so I'm getting rid of this. And we said, well, do you play music? And he said, yeah, I'm a DJ. Mm-hmm. And so we said, oh, okay, great. And as we negotiated the price of the laptop, I don't know if you ever heard this. As we negotiated the price of the laptop, because the guy wanted considerably more than we paid him. Mm-hmm. But at one point, Corey had just heard, he had had enough of the negotiating, and he offered him a price. And he said, listen, take this price. He wasn't asking. He said, I'm telling you, take this price. And, you know, we had built a rapport with the guy. He was a nice guy. Corey said, take this price, and I'm going to tell you who this laptop's going to belong to when you hand it over to me. Mm-hmm. And the guy sat there for a moment, and he thought, what are you saying? And he looked over at Pete. And Pete just leaned into him and said, you should take the deal. Mm-hmm. And he looked at me and I said, you should take the deal. And the guy looked, and we didn't say that in a threatening way, just matter-of-factly, like, you will not be sorry if you take this deal. Mm-hmm. And so the guy decided, okay, I'll take the deal. Handed over the laptop to Corey. Mm-hmm. And Corey said, your laptop now belongs to Sly Stone. And this guy lost his mind. He lost his mind. And he was a young man.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
He was younger than we are. I mean, I would say the guy was, you know, 30 maybe.
Mm-hmm. Maybe, yeah.
And he lost his mind because he's a DJ. Yeah. He knows what your impact on music is.
That's good.
He went crazy.
He started physically shaking.
He did. He could not stay still. His hands were shaking. He couldn't believe that his laptop, like, he just become a part of a family tree that he was not prepared to become a part of.
That's good.
And then Corey picked up, this part you probably remember, Corey picked up the phone and called you.
and said, Sly, will you talk to this individual because he's losing his mind over here? And then you talked to him for like 10 minutes. And we thought, that's nice. That's really nice of Sly, but we're trying to leave. But that's the impact you still leave behind.
That's good.
Yeah. How much do you feel that? Because it seems like you don't leave the house much. You just sit at home and make music.
I'd rather do that.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
You've soured of the world?
No, I'd rather play music and just rather play music.
Yeah. All day long.
Yeah.
Dave Agent.
Stan is one of the greatest albums in my life. That album is the pinnacle of Sly and the Family Stone, without a doubt. With Larry Graham's technique and Sly's arrangements, it's literally a masterpiece, rock and roll, R&B, funk, whatever you want to call it. It's just a master. I hang the progress of funk on Sly, without a doubt. If Steve Jobs put a dent in the universe, that dude put a dent in the music world. Yeah, and it's still there.
I'm going to tell you another story, Sly.
Mm-hmm.
A couple years ago, mm-hmm. I was sitting at home. Corey called me. You had sent him up to Vallejo
mm-hmm.
to retrieve some items out of a trailer that you had mm-hmm. up there. And among them were a couple of guns that you were storing up there. Mm-hmm. Corey doesn't know anything about guns, so he called me and said, hey, man, I need some help. I want to make sure I don't shoot myself in the foot.
Mm-hmm.
Can you come help me? I said, sure. What do you want to do? He said, I got to get some stuff that belongs to Sly in this trailer mm-hmm. over at Trailer City. And so we went over there.
Mm-hmm.
We went kind of organized your belongings and went through the stuff. And I made sure that Corey had packed away the guns all neatly so that he didn't shoot himself in the foot. But we went through there and did an inventory of whatever that we could find in that were clothes and what was gear, what was usable, what didn't work anymore, whatever. Some of the stage clothes that he brought them back. So you know, you saw them.
Stuff and they were stolen.
What? Wow.
Oh, I hate hearing that.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, he brought back some things that we were just going, oh, look at this. And I mean, things that had things that you wore on stage, things that you wore on Soul Train, things that you wore that made your some crazy, shiny, crazy shit.
Yeah,
really.
Shiny, crazy, fluffy.
Yeah. A fur coat.
Yeah.
One thing in there was a fur coat. Another thing was a jumpsuit that had sequins all over it.
Red,
and it was, and
red,
it,
black.
Yeah, yeah. And it said Sly on the back. Like, oh, man. What an awesome life it is when you get to wear this at work.
Is there a time when you met like Elvis and you went, I can't believe I'm talking to Elvis? Is there anybody that really shocked you like that?
Frank Sinatra.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So me and Billy Preston were going up to the elevator in Hawaii. And Johnny, Johnny Winters was there. And he was in there already. And Johnny said, what's up? And I don't know why I did that, son, like an asshole, but I did it. I said, hey, what's up? He said, what's up? I said, Edgar. that's Johnny's guy. But, you know, but we laughed.
Yeah.
And we got upstairs, and there was Frank. And he was in so much awe of me that I felt weird.
Wow.
I mean, he appreciated me more than I knew how to appreciate him. And I kept telling him, man, you're Frank Sinatra, a little bit. You Sly, but he
and he was saying, never mind that. Let's talk about you.
Yeah. And it was, I got kind of weird.
Huh.
And I said,
He could have said, well, I'm Frank Sinatra, but I can't get away with wearing a sequin jumpsuit that says Frank on the back of it. Only you can do that.
Hey, who had the better fro, you or Billy Preston? Because yours was awesome. But Billy's, like, he can move his head and his hair would stay still.
I don't know.
Yeah. Billy's fro was, if he turned too fast, it, like, his fro would catch up a second later. You know, like, he did a move on stage, he'd go pow, and the fro would slide into place.
Hey, whose work stands out to you when you hear their music? You think, man, like, here's a story. REM has a lead singer named Michael Stipe, and he was at a U2 concert, and he's like, I wish I would have wrote Beautiful Day. That's my song. I should have wrote that. And he says it with all the love in the world because he loves the band, but he's like, man, I just love that song. Do you have someone like that where you hear what they do and you're just like, oh, man, I wish that I could have wrote that?
Or yeah. Some song that you hear and you go, you know, if you had waited around too long, I would have ended up writing that for you.
Mm-hmm. Excuse me, Ray Charles?
Yeah.
And Beatles?
Mm-hmm. Ray Charles and the Beatles.
Yeah.
That's a pretty good company.
Yeah. Yeah. Have you ever played with Ray Charles?
Yeah, but not
in a performance setting?
Right.
How was that?
It's crazy, yeah. Ray Charles is just, you know, just perfect all of it.
Yeah.
But it just resolves everything every second and it goes on.
Wow.
That's some heavy theory right there.
That is heavy.
Yeah.
This is Mick Gillette from the Tower of Power, and I have been a Sly Stone fan since the early days on KSOL radio. And we all used to play Frenchies and Hayward back in the late 60s. And I got to tell you, my favorite rock and roll picture of all time is hanging on my wall at home. And it's got Van Morrison sitting at a big grand piano. And sitting next to him is Bill Wyman, the Rolling Stones bass player, and he's playing an acoustic guitar. And sitting right next to him is Sly Stone playing bass. And right next to him is me playing trombone. And this is just my favorite little quartet I ever played in. Happy birthday to Sly. I hope you remember it.
Do you see your legacy when you look around at artists who are emerging now? And do you see hints of your influence in people?
Yeah, a lot of times.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, for us, it's inescapable. We look at it and we go, oh, yeah.
It's good feeling.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. What's an example of that influence that you see?
You know, their style of doing music and how they act and how they're... There are a lot of guys.
Yeah. I mean, you kind of changed just the way that a front man takes the stage. You know.
I didn't know who to copy.
Uh-huh.
So just, you know, just have to go up and do what you do.
Yeah.
And wind up whatever you do.
This is the most listened to DJ in the universe, DJ Severe.
Wow. In my repertoire, Sly represents, to me, that soul funk with the edge of a little rebellion, but not over the top, taking it to the man, so to speak. Love City's my favorite Sly joint. I just love the beat and a lot of the message in it, but also bringing everyone together at the same time. I love what he represents as far as funk, soul, and pop, and to the rhythm. He's definitely what I use a lot in the stadium just because the horns, the bass line, the strings, and just growing up, just a real deep representation of being proud. And I think the one thing that I think that's just the signature Bay Area sound. And those of us in music just kind of just gravitated into it more just being that way. Like, that was pretty much the sound of the Bay, you know. And you see some of the other groups that have come around and kind of have that signature swag. A lot of people don't even know how much music actually comes from the Bay and what it represents, even down to the hip-hop. I think it kind of helps separate Northern California from Southern California, but I think it represented it so much. And to me, just basically representative of the Bay and that Bay Area sound.
Yeah.
You know, one thing I love about your especially the early work with the Family Stone Band, is, yeah, you were the leader and you sang a lot, but you weren't the only one that sang. That singing tool got passed around to everybody, and I can't think of another band that does that within a song. Like, the Eagles might go out and tour and it'll be Joe Walsh's song or whoever's song, but you're like, hey, I need you to sing here, I need you to sing there. And
every song was everybody's song.
Damn, it's beautiful. You know?
That's good. That's good. Well, I got some good singers.
Yeah, yeah. You did have some good singers.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that I think is really important with people like him, like Rosie, these really super hyper duper genius musician people.
Mm-hmm.
So anyone who is a musician knows that this information, if you're writing music, this stuff doesn't come from your brain or all the hours of studying. I mean, that helps, makes it easier, the process easier, but it comes from somewhere else.
It allows you to be
a channel.
Yeah.
If you're a musician, you really are a channel. Yep. This stuff doesn't come from you.
You let your spirit speak.
When you have someone like that, or some, you know, like Sly Stone, who is that prolific and that genius in his writing, how open is that guy to receiving all this information? He's getting so much information. It must be insane for him.
Yep. He knows openness.
Just to process that. All that information
when
that's coming to him.
Think in those terms.
I've had one experience where I got a song that came all at once. All the lyrics, the melody, all the instrumentation, all came at once. I couldn't keep up with it. It came so fast. But that guy, Prince, those kind of people, Rose, it must be a constant streaming
video in their head. They see it. They see the whole picture.
Yeah.
When you try to understand Sly, like they write these stories about how he lives and his financial condition, that is not important to him. He doesn't have time to deal with that. He's got this channel.
And he needs to get it through.
That's his purpose for Sly and for all of us as music. That was what made me decide to, okay, you know, I'm going to have to do it because it's my responsibility. If I'm getting this information, then I got to get over my ego and just
allow it.
Don't
through.
Give a F yeah. and put it out there.
Right.
But I do think that people get a lot of musicians get a bad rap, especially as they get older, and the money's not there anymore, right. and things start to fade out. You know, many musicians self-medicate with whatever yes. their choice is.
Yeah.
To try to deal with the monsters under their beds.
Yes.
Yep.
And we all have them. And we all deal with it as musicians. It's a thing we don't, a lot of people don't really talk about it, but it is a fact of being a musician. You do have voices in your head.
What must feel good from him, though, is he doesn't have to hide. Sly doesn't have to hide shit.
Mm-mm. And he don't want to.
Be him 200%. Sly is always him, and he always has been. And no matter how anyone else took it, he was still like, whatever.
And his message is so powerful
now.
And so positive.
It's Sly would feel like I'm going on the side of the stage, have a drink of water. I'll be right back. The song's still going.
Yeah.
Come back. Just I'm going to use the restroom. And and that's so real. You know what I mean? Keep it real. And they
unapologetically authentic.
Can you think of another artist that gave up the lead singing position as much as he did?
Because it was about
his message. Right. His message was bigger than his music.
Yeah. You know one person I think of when you say that? I think of Dwayne.
Yes.
Mm.
Yeah, the way they would do songs and stack it, you know what I mean? He'd say one thing, and then his sister would come in and scream, like, I'm healing out. All that. Mm-hmm. Graham come in.
That's right.
It was a family affair.
Yeah, right.
It was.
And Sly made sure it stayed that way, too.
Yep.
And you could always look at his performances like he is just, sometimes, I mean, I feel that way, too. I'm not saying I can feel like Sly, but I can understand what you're saying.
Yeah.
He just wants to do music. I'm like, what the fuck else would you want to do now?
That's
I mean,
right.
It's like, that's all I want to do.
Everybody, that's it.
Let the music speak.
That's the most important thing to me is that inclusiveness and that music really does bring people together.
Yep.
So that everybody feels a part of this. And I think that's really powerful. He's so ahead of his time. Sly Stone was amazing.
Yes. And we still have him. That's dope. You see, it's in
the blood. This is Jay Moore.
Jay, when you are able to go on the road and consume the amount of music that you have consumed as a touring comedian, I get the feeling that any time that the mic and the light weren't on, you had tunes going. And you weren't just blindly consuming. Yeah, you were taking it in.
Constantly, yeah.
Like a veteran.
All day. I sing standards. I sing to my son.
But specifically Sly Stone, man, what do you think, what difference did he make?
Huge difference in music because we know the hits, but then when you get deep into these albums, like Family Affair, like, yeah, everybody knows Family Affair that I just sang, but third verse, he's kind of just talking, but he's talking in a way, not talk singing like bad talk singing, you know, and guys are like, and then I went to the store and I just thought like Red Hot Chili Peppers, but he's like,
Lord, let's love everybody. Oh, like it's almost like this real sexy, deep drawl, but he's talking about the love of the family stone, and the family affair. Ooh, child, let's love. And it's kind of like the minimalism of what the minimalism, the choice, the placement of the words. I don't know what the recording process was like, but nothing's wasted and nothing's superfluous.
You know, if you compare it to the really highly produced stuff of the time, let's say, I mean, even though it was elementary when it compares to some of the stuff we're doing now, but if you went for like the Temptations or, you know, a band like that, that was really where the orchestration and the arrangement and stuff was very, very rehearsed. And then you turn the mic on Sly and he's just doing his thing and growling. And that's what's minimalist about it.
I think Sly is produced so much better because he knew when to lay off. And when you mention the Temptations, even like Otis Redding, and it's kind of overproduced. Like everybody like jacks off to Phil Spector and the Wall of Sound. It's like, bro, it's Be My Little Baby. What Wall of Sound?
Yeah.
Like nobody listens to Be My Little Baby and goes, holy shit, listen to that best. No, when you listen to the James Gang and realize it's only three guys, you go, what the fuck? That's a wall of sound,
that's
man.
A wall
Nirvana,
of sound.
That's a wall of sound.
When Mick Gillette blows his horn, that's a wall of sound.
Pete, can we ever have a conversation without you? We know, Pete, you're a top. We're bottoms. We got it, buddy.
Hey, man.
Oh, hold on. Yeah. I got Cindy Crawford calling me again. I got to go.
All right. How in shape are you to play live?
When rehearsing is what I want to do.
Yeah.
Get the rehearsing done. And
right.
Then it's no job.
Okay. So you're not going to present it before it's time.
Well, I don't like to jam too much because I get, it blows my head into my head. It feels like I got to do better than everybody, and that's not what the thing is about.
Still? You still feel that way?
Yeah,
I mean,
well,
that's a competitive streak that a young musician would feel, but you still have that?
Yeah, I want to just do it better every day. And that's not a good thing, maybe, but it's rehearsing, guys, you know?
Yeah.
You do it all day, and you got a certain feeling about a song, and you know what it is, right? And you get something that means a lot. It's a hint. It's something to make you lean over and hit a chord. You have to do that.
Right.
You know, so when you're rehearsing, you know, to that extent, you know, that's what you do. And, well, yeah, that's what I like to do with a lot of people. The people God get to where they, man, their mother was crazy. But, yeah, you know, that's what it is.
You are crazy a little bit.
Yeah.
That's all right, though.
Yeah.
It's been many, many years, I think, that you've cultivated this sense. And you don't think with what you created at a young age and the stuff that you were able to say, here's my stamp on the world. Now what you going to do with it?
That's all I know is what I do.
Yeah. Wow. So tell us some wacky stories about people from throughout time that are remarkable or that you think, you know, or that amused you or whatever. Drop some wisdom on us.
I don't know stories right now. but I can, I tell you what.
I heard Miles Davis pulled a gun on you.
He pulled a gun in the
Is that true?
Everybody in the room.
He pulled a gun on everybody in the room.
Yeah, I told him, pull that shit down, man. I know he's funny. He's got to be telling jokes. I mean,
that was Miles being funny? He pulled a gun on everybody in the room?
Yeah, he came in with the gun. I said, put that shit down, man. You can't do that. And he put it down.
Okay. You probably had a tone in your voice like, man, I'm from Vallejo. I got a .32 in my pocket.
No,
you better put that down.
But I didn't feel any
animosity.
Yeah,
or,
nothing.
Yeah.
But you know, he had a gun, so and everybody was a little wacky. No, you can't do that, Miles. Don't do that.
At his house? At a party? No. What makes you...
At a place like a little studio at 25 Central Park West. Yeah.
25 Central Park West. Wow. Okay. I guess, man, what do you do with that? I mean, that's Miles Davis. And you go, hey, man, you're armed and dangerous.
Yeah.
Yeah, you live in a and lived in a rock star world where people did have different rules and everything.
Mm-hmm.
Among those guys, who really stands out as being just over the top? You're like, man, I hope you know Bob doesn't come over because that guy is crazy.
So Charles Manson.
No shit. All right, tell us about that.
No, he needed to get out of there. I didn't know who he was. I didn't know that he was leaving. I didn't know Doris wanted to get out. But she's sort of winding down.
Well, hold on. Wait a minute. You jumped ahead of us here. What? You talking about Charles Manson?
Mm-hmm.
He hung out with a lot of musicians.
Yeah.
So what was going on there?
I just realized that he had to get out of the house because Doris, that's the way I felt about Doris Day. She's just a nice lady, that's all.
Yeah?
So I thought maybe you ought to get out, sir. So I got in and I started encouraging him to get out.
How do you encourage?
You have a
Charles
way
Manson?
Of mildly encouraging people to do something.
Well, you have got to go.
Uh huh. So you mildly encouraged Charles Manson to exit the premises, and he left.
Yeah, he got out.
And then he became Charles Manson in somebody else's house.
Yeah.
What was he doing there?
Getting people. You could tell he was crazy.
Yeah, and he was trying to pull people into his.
He was doing it. I could see him doing it.
Yeah. Back then, when, you know, musical styles were kind of melting together, who do you think was responsible for really mixing styles more than anybody else? Who was the more adventurous of the musicians that you knew around then?
You should think about...
Who did you admire for their sense of creativity?
Kind of hard to say, man. Everybody was in a category.
Yeah.
And they stayed there.
What allowed you to break those categories, though? Because you weren't beholden to the categories. You kind of did what you wanted to do.
Because that's just the way I saw it. You know?
Yeah.
I just know if I got a good record, then it's country and western, then it would be that. I know it would be that.
Yeah.
That's the way it is.
And your record company trusted you.
They had to.
You were going to give them what you were going to give them. Hey,
yeah, honest to God, yeah.
That's wow.
When rehearsing for that, for the good reasons and everybody's into it, they got to like it.
You can't do that anymore.
No. Yeah, you can.
You think so?
Yeah.
You just think people aren't doing it as much as they should be.
Yeah, people just don't have the stupidity or the courage or whatever it takes to say what you got to say and do it with no harm in it.
Yeah.
Like, this is it.
Not everybody has that much to say, Sly.
I believe that.
Not everybody has that much to say. Did you know Levon Helm?
I've heard the name.
Oh, okay. Yeah. I thought maybe you knew him because I love him. Mm-hmm. I mean, I was a big, big fan, and he was just seemed to be the same kind of free spirit that you were. And I was curious to know if you guys crossed paths, but it seems like you guys didn't cross paths. Did the band play Woodstock?
The band played at Woodstock.
I mean, there was several days between you guys, probably.
Is there a song that you've written that you thought, this is a great song, and it's going to be a hit, and it just absolutely is not a hit? Is there a song like that there for you?
Oh, yeah. Underdog. Yeah, it's just a fucking song, but I could find out what was wrong. I got Dave Kaplan, and he told me it's kind of just the beat and the words. It's got to be a melody. It's got to punish the song. And that's what it's got to be only. And that's why I take it. So I wrote Dance to the Music.
Okay.
Like, it's a formula that's easy to do. Like, you just add some sugar and you put in a little bit of...
Kind of like that, yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. How many songs do you think you've got in the catalog now that you're waiting to release?
Yeah. You are always, regardless of what else is going on, always working on a song.
Well, I like to be ready, you know.
And you talked about someone just right then who was an influence on how to write songs.
Who was it? Can you say the name again? I didn't catch it.
Dave Kaplick.
Dave Kaplick.
My first manager.
Okay.
Okay.
The first and the last.
What happened to him?
He got tired of it. He got money and go to Hawaii.
He got money and took off to Hawaii.
Yeah,
that was it
cool
for that.
He's cool as far as I know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Good for him.
Yeah.
Yeah. But he sort of left you in a position where you are now, where you have to fight over stuff.
You got it. You're right. Believe me, I cannot do it for much longer. I know. You know.
Yeah.
Whatever has to take place, this is going to have to take place. I will pay them to get me off. I don't give me the lawyer. off. I ain't mad at nobody. I'm through with it.
Yeah. You're not worried about the money. Not worried about anything. You just want to be done with it and go on to write music.
Man.
Wow. Let's talk about music. What are you feeling now? I mean, when you go, when you go into your notebook, when you're writing music, you've always written songs about happiness and love and a good time, sometimes a woman. What are you writing about nowadays?
What I don't like about court.
Wow.
Man, you're angry.
You're writing about what you don't like about court.
Yeah, and managers and all that people.
Yeah. I want to hear Sly's version of No Vaseline, because that's what we're talking about right now.
Yeah.
You know?
I want this stuff to go away.
Yeah.
I can't believe how much of a hindrance this is on your soul.
Man. Believe me, man.
My goodness.
I don't even... The voices of the people that are supposed to represent me, they make me...
You don't think you're being represented fairly?
I don't know.
Wow.
I don't think they know how. That's what I think.
Yeah.
And maybe I don't know.
Right.
But I don't care. They can have whatever they got to get, and I can get what I got to get, and bye.
And be done with it already.
Yeah, because I can't do that stuff. I don't want it like that. I don't like that kind of money.
Yeah. So with regard to, can we talk about any of this stuff?
Yeah, talk about anything. That's what it's gotten to that.
Okay. So what are you fighting over? What's everybody fighting over?
I don't know what the fuck they're fighting over now. I don't know. They just bother me.
Everybody wants a piece of Sly Stone.
Yeah. They can have the parts that I know about.
Yeah.
Just leave it alone.
Wow.
There's a limit to what you're going to take. You know that.
Yeah.
And you go to that limit, and I'm trying to make them understand, and I don't see anything beyond the people that are involved in my life now.
Mm-hmm.
They feel to me as if they are enemies. My lawyers, their lawyer, I'm in with a lawsuit that is so stupid, I wish I could get out of it. I would have... as a matter of fact, I've already started in challenging everybody with a lie detector test. I would rather be, I'd better get on a polygraph test and ask me anything.
Right, right.
Rather than go on an argument stuff.
Well,
it's craziness.
Yeah, it's a lot of craziness.
Yeah, they don't know me.
And I don't have anything to do with that lawsuit and no business speaking about it, so don't come after me, lawyers. What I will say is that in the short time that I've known Sly, he's a beautiful human being, and he just wants to make music.
Man, that's exactly right. He wants to make music. That's what he said over and over again.
Can we just let the man make music
for
crying
out loud? That's all I'm saying.
Yeah.
Do you plan to release this music in some form?
Yeah.
Okay, great.
Are we going to see you take the stage live with a band at any time soon?
Yeah, I plan that it's going to be heard.
Okay.
Yeah, that's what I plan. I'm not just planning to record this stuff, because...
We want to see you live. Mm-hmm. Are you going to take Corey?
Yep.
Because we want to see Corey. We don't get enough of Corey.
I know.
He likes the original band, too.
Mm-hmm.
So, when? What are you planning? We want to know what you're planning, man.
Right now, I'm getting these... What I want to do now is get these people functioning at a lawsuit off. I'm pissed off at these people, all of them. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
I'm never going to take that. I get like that now 24 hours a day.
These lawsuits are just looming over you.
I don't like that stuff.
Is there an end in sight? Is there an end in sight with these lawsuits?
No, what did they say? But I don't see it. But I know there's an end real soon, because I know me. I will be through.
Wow.
Pretty soon, I don't care.
Yeah.
I'm tired of it.
Wow.
And all the stories, man, and all the lies. That's why I just wish I just tell, ask me anything in front of all the people.
Right.
I'll tell the truth, man. And whatever happens, good.
Yeah.
And that's the God's truth. My brother brought up just do all of us, polygraph tests. Everybody went. I didn't know that, but they got really weird.
That was thin the herd pretty quickly.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, I found that to be true too, Sly. Yeah. Is that if you challenge somebody and say, let's go do it. You know, mm-hmm. I'm big on, all right, you're going to say this is true. I'm going to say that's true. Let's go do it. Let's see what happens. Maybe not be a lie detector test, but mm-hmm. it's going to be work. Let's go do work.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and let's see what comes out.
Because mm-hmm.
the bottom line is your job isn't to be in court. Your yeah. job is to be in front of a mixing board
yeah,
and
yeah.
a keyboard. Mm-hmm. That's, damn it, that's where we want
and
you.
And put
you
love know? In the world.
Man, that person is not love in the world.
found hope in the midst of an overwhelming situation.
I let go of trying to control things that I had no control over, and that helped me find peace of mind.
Alcoholism is a disease that can affect any family. Everyone suffers, but there is help and hope at Al-Anon Family Groups.
I was constantly stressed and worried. Now I approach each day with joy and gratitude.
In Al-Anon, families and friends of alcoholics find new ways to heal from the effects of a loved one's drinking.
Al-Anon gave me my life back. I'm a better father and husband.
Are you in an overwhelming situation because of someone else's drinking?
Al-Anon and Alateen can help.
Local and virtual meetings are available. Maybe one could work for you. For information, call 1-866-200-0033 or visit alanon.org/hope.
Everyone has a community, a neighborhood, school, place of worship, or other chosen groups. Communities can provide support when you need it, including helping your kids avoid underage drinking and other substance use. Learn more at talktheyhearyou.samhsa.gov.
GOAT, G-O-A-T, acronym, stands for Greatest of All Time, as in spaghetti sandwiches for dinner? They're my fave. Dad, you're the GOAT.
You don't have to speak teen to be a perfect parent. Thousands of teens in foster care will love you just the same.